This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Imagine a time when Arabs, Jews, and Christians lived together for centuries in peace, when religious tolerance was encoded in the laws of government, and literature, science, and art flourished. Was there ever such a time? There was, and what's more, it all happened in the dark, barbaric Middle Ages. From the 8th to the 15th century in Andalusia, Spain, the world's three dominant cultures forged a stable, enlightened Muslim civilization far more advanced than anything in Northern Europe at the time. This often overlooked era is the subject of Maria Rosa Menocal's new book, The Ornament of the World: How Muslims, Jews, and Christians Created a Culture of Tolerance in Medieval Spain. Menocal is a professor of Spanish and Portuguese at Yale University. In the year 711, Muslim armies crossed the Straits of Gibraltar from northern Africa into Spain. But Menocal says that the Muslim empire in Spain didn't begin to take shape until decades later.
Then this remarkable event takes place in 750, and that is that the caliph, who is, of course, the ruler of the entire entity of Islam, the caliph actually means the successor to the prophet, and so he is the temporal as well as the spiritual leader of the entirety of the community. The caliph in Damascus at that point is overthrown, and in a bloody coup, his entire family is wiped out, except for one young man, who was, in fact, the grandson of the caliph. And it's this wonderful Anastasia-like story, except that unlike Anastasia, he actually turns up, and he turns up 5 years later over in Morocco. But of course, by the time he gets out there, all of, you know, most of the interesting and important people had themselves already migrated over to the other side of the Straits of Gibraltar. So he goes over, and he realizes that here is a place where he can not only find refuge, but set up his own universe, in effect, a court in exile. In Spain now, we're talking, after about the middle of the 8th century, and he does so. And for me, this is the far more important date, which is really 755, 56, because if this had not happened, this would always have just been an outlying province. But what this man does is he arrives and he says, you know, I am the heir to the caliphate. And towards the end of his life already, he begins to build what will become and what is the great mosque of Cordoba. So he lived for a long time and he transformed. It's you suddenly see this is not just some province. This is the new center of a dynasty and a vision of culture in exile. So it completely changes the vision.
So what was the makeup then of this early empire? There were Christians, there were Jews, there was this rising Islamic caliphate, this young, mm-hmm. dynamic ruler out there on the frontier. Who controlled what, and what rungs on the socioeconomic ladder did each group occupy?
Well, clearly the Muslims were the dominant political force. And the results of this were very different for the Christian community and the Jewish community. For the Jewish community, the results were almost unambiguously positive. The previous era in Spain had been dominated by the old Germanic Visigothic government, which was, you know, this was the continuation of the Germanic tribes that had, you know, sacked Rome. Literally, the Visigoths are the tribe that sacks Rome in the 5th century. And so when the Muslims arrive, both as settlers and then with the coming of this new leadership, they find a place that is, I think, hungry for a different vision of society. And the truth is that the vast majority of Muslims in the peninsula, after a fairly short period of time, are all converts from the original populations who might have been Christians or might have been, you know, so loosely Christians that they might, in fact, have only been Christians in name. There's some evidence that out in the countryside in particular, they may still have been pagans and so forth. So the Christians converted in very large numbers, and this created problems for the Christian community. But the Jews had been in a virtually enslaved situation during the last years of the Visigoths, and so they were suddenly not only not enslaved, but were protected, encouraged to become Arabized, in fact, without, as far as we can tell, any particular defections from the religion itself. And by the early part of the 10th century, i.e. within a century or so after all of this starts to happen, it's clear that the communities of Jews are thoroughly integrated into the upper echelons of the Muslim society.
Now, you write what helped the Jewish minority assimilate and live in harmony with their Arab neighbors, and also to a great extent the Christian minority also, was a culture of tolerance that that Islam fostered. What was that based on? What was the foundation for that?
The foundation for it is something that is called the Pact of Umar, which is a very brief statement of protection for peoples of the book. And this appears very early on in the history of Islam. It's based on a couple of things. It's explicitly based on the recognition of the fact that, unlike pagans, or polytheists in that sense, that Jews and Christians are, as they are called, the peoples of the book, i.e. they share a scriptural tradition with the Muslims. So it's rather explicitly a recognition that these three religions, even though they're monotheistic and thus necessarily contradict each other, are nevertheless have a special intertwined history and are distinguished from others by having sacred books. So this puts them in a very special category, which entitles them to protection within an Islamic state.
What did that mean? How was the this you call it the Dhimmi? Is
It's called the Dhimmi. Yes, it's
a series of teachings
Well, no, Dhimmi means peoples of the book, and thus protected peoples. And technically, what the law says is that they are protected. They may not be executed or persecuted, and they do not have to convert. It's a very different attitude, by the way. Pagans, you can execute, you can force to convert. So forced conversion is prohibited vis-a-vis these two groups, but permitted for others. And they are not, however, equal because they're not Muslims, and it's a Muslim regime. And the major limitations or the major differences are, first of all, that they have to pay a tax, which the Muslims do not have to pay. So you're taxed in that sense. And the other limitation, which is very interesting, is that they're not allowed to build new religious monuments or proselytize among others. Again, this last one is you can, because of course, actually building new monuments can be seen as being a form of proselytizing, couldn't be interpreted that way. The question of to what degree this was enforced during different periods is much discussed.
What were the long-term effects of this tolerance? Did it mean that Jews and Christians and Arabs shared a common culture and something that you see in the architecture of Spain, in the poetry, in the shared language?
Right. Well, what's interesting is that the first several centuries, from about, if we say roughly from 750 to 1000, it is a period during which this Islamic polity does have this formal tolerance that is based on the principles that we've discussed. But what happens as a result of that is that you begin to develop a very important cultural tolerance. In other words, what takes root during this period of time is this wonderful idea, which is really for me what that culture of tolerance is about, is this wonderful idea that culture itself, which means everything from the language that you speak to the architecture of the house of worship that you are in to the literature and philosophy that you read, is not something that ought to be determined or judged on the ideological grounds of your religion. So that, in fact, they have a shared cultural identity, which does not, of course, prevent religious intolerance or political mayhem or all sorts of things. But I think sometimes it slows it down, in fact. I mean, I think it suggests that the shared everyday things trump these theological constructs, which may be difficult for everyday people to think are more important.
Well, you write that also this was a golden age of Jewish culture.
Yes, it
and,
is.
And that one of the things that was contributing towards this tolerance was an ability among the Jewish people to accept contradiction in
yes.
one's own identity, that was very much a force in the leading thought of the time and religious thought in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, it is a very interesting fact that, of course, the Jewish community did blossom because it was able to be an assimilated part of the civic community around themselves without feeling that this made them any less Jewish in any way. Although, of course, the voices contradicting this posture would eventually arise, which is why I say that the really interesting struggles are not among the groups, but for, so to speak, for the hearts and minds of whether it's Jews or Muslims or Christians. So the question for the Jewish community, which was in fact not asked for a very long time, would eventually be posed as something like, well, can you be a good Jew and, know Greek philosophy inside out, or is an acceptance of philosophy a contradiction with being a Jew, or can you be a good Jew and, you know, sing songs or write poetry that is, even if it's in Hebrew, is so thoroughly, clearly Arabized?
I'm speaking with Maria Rosa Menocal. She's a professor of Spanish and Portuguese at Yale University. She's also the director of the Whitney Humanities Center there. Her new book is The Ornament of the World, How Muslims, Jews, and Christians Created a Culture of Tolerance in Medieval Spain. Maria, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Maria Rosa Menocal. She's a professor of Spanish and Portuguese at Yale University, and her new book is about a period of medieval history in which Jews, Arabs, and Christians lived together in peace in Spain. It's called The Ornament of the World. Can you talk about some of the ways that medieval society differed from ours today, which would account for the ability to tolerate each other's religious differences? For instance, this idea of nation states, mm-hmm. that didn't arise till much, much later.
That's right.
And I think borders were so much more fluid in the Middle Ages, and that must be a factor.
One of the things that happens during that period is the rise of the modern nation states, and one of the things that ends up crystallizing is a far more homogeneous notion of cultural identity than the one that it replaces, because it does come to define your citizenship in a given entity as that of the state. And it's a state where everybody else who's a member of that community speaks the same language and is of the same religion and perhaps is even, or at least you pretend, is of the same ethnic group. And so you have the beginnings of the development of these far more, in my opinion, limited notions of what people are and what they can be, certainly within Islamic Spain and in the Mediterranean. I think the circumstances are really very different in Northern Europe. This shared culture and the fact that you did have not only Muslims and Jews and Christians that did live side by side, not necessarily always in peace, but also not necessarily believing that they were living in different communities either in that sense. There was an ability to be multiple things at the same time. So you could be a good citizen of the city of Granada and be a good Jew. And in fact, you might even be the leader of the Jewish community and be the right-hand man to the ruler of that city. And of course, you could also believe in Greek philosophy at the same time. And so there's a greater richness and variety, particularly in the Mediterranean area, which I think can breed and can thrive in a culture of tolerance. It can also, of course, if lines get drawn, produce the opposite.
So what brought about the collapse of the culture?
Well, it's, as I said, the tension was always there, the collapse of the culture of tolerance inside of Spain. I think there's several different things that happen. One is that the Islamic state as a unified peninsular government was destroyed in the year 1000. The political fate of that went downhill from then on in. It's a complicated political history, but it basically has first about 100 years when it's broken down into these feuding city-states. And then it went from there to one where you had these Muslims who came in from Morocco who were very fundamentalist and who thought that the Andalusian Muslims were these decadent people who did all of these things that they didn't approve of, including their interpretation of the dhimma and so on and so forth, who colonized them basically for 100 years. And so on the one hand, you had the Muslim government in retreat and becoming more and more hardline. I mean, meanwhile, within Spain and in the north, the imposition or the bringing to the peninsula of these basically Roman, and I use that to mean the rest of the church, notions of Christianity that were by nature, I think, theologically more intolerant, but also by cultural practice, were ideas about the interpretation of what the church should be that had been developed within communities that had never known what it was to live with a Muslim or a Jew. The combination of all of these factors, so that by the time you get to the 14th and 15th centuries, the number of people who are still in a position to maintain tolerant civil states are diminished. The culture itself is still there, but it's endangered because the lines in the sand have been drawn.
If we can talk just specifically in terms of Israel and Israelis and Palestinians mm-hmm. right now today, mm-hmm. I think some, some Israelis and Palestinians would say that as recently as even 4 or 5 years ago,
yes.
that they shared a common culture
yes.
and that peace was attainable mm-hmm. in large part because of that. And that rather than this being this long historic enmity, peace has disintegrated in a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what your perspective on that is, given that you take a very long view of history.
Well, maybe that's another positive way of looking at it, is to look at the long view and to understand that when you're, in a given moment, it can look very terrible and negative and so forth. And yet, for me, part of the recent history of the recent events, I should say, has allowed me to understand the history more that I couldn't understand before, because it used to seem to me so mysterious of, how could you have 1 year, this one really spectacular instance of coexistence and great culture and so forth, and then the next year you'd have a riot that killed, all of these Jews in one community and so forth, and the frailty of things. And
if there were a tipping point.
As if there were a tipping point. And again, I think that's something for people who have a voice and decisions to make to understand, which is the frailty of these arrangements, even when the good is so great and even when the bad is so terrible, that the line is such a thin one. For me, the greatest example of this in the history of Spain is, in effect, the story of 1492, which is when, on the 1st of January, Ferdinand and Isabella go and take possession of the city of Granada, which had been the last, and in fact, for 250 years, had been this little isolated Muslim kingdom. 250 years is a long time, but it's like the little footnote at the end of that whole medieval history. And the contemporaries tell the story of how Isabella marches up the hill dressed in her finest Moorish garb. I mean, she was still dressed literally in the culture, and she wasn't making fun of anyone. And moreover, she marches up there with her Jewish advisors, who were her closest advisors, who, in fact, had arranged her marriage to Ferdinand, who had her Jewish doctor had been the one who had treated her for, I think it was her infertility problems. She had desperate to have a child. So, you know, the march up the hill is in this one cultural mode. Within 3 months, she was signing the edict to expel the Jews, including those same men that she had. And within a very short period of time after that, the provisions of the treatise that allowed the takeover of Granada, which stipulated Dhimmi-like protection for the Muslims, were not actually officially revoked necessarily, but were clearly allowed to be overridden. So within a very short period of time, you went from something where at least the possibility of a very different future was there to one where that possible future was really irreparably blown up and was unrecoverable eventually. And in fact, the bottom line is she did it because the church had the greater influence on her.
Maria Rosa Menocal is the director of the Whitney Humanities Center at Yale University. Her new book is The Ornament of the World. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.